Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I'd just like to thank tonight's author for coming out, and so without further ado, I'd like to introduce Claire Cameron.
Thank you very much for coming. Okay, I thought what I'd do tonight is do a short reading and then talk about two of the inspirations, the things that kind of came together to, I was starting to write The Bear. So first, though, I'm going to tell a little story just because I've been traveling a bit to promote the book. And Jim Bull, who's from Boulder, a very good friend of mine, we lived at the same time in San Francisco and work together now, gave me a hot tip before I came to the States, and that was Uber, the app. Is everyone familiar with the app? And that it was a good way to get cars and move around because I'm going to several bookstores and that sort of thing. So I downloaded Uber and I tried it in Toronto, where I'm from in Canada. Worked perfectly, and I got a limo to the airport, and it was great. So I was in Chicago last night, and I was going to City Lit bookstore, and I opened Uber, and Uber said it was different than it was in Canada, and it had Uber X, and I clicked on it, and it said, oh, it's just like Uber, but cheaper. And I thought, well, I like cheap things, so that's perfect. So I clicked on Uber X, and this car drove up, and I thought, wow, that looks like just some guy in his car. And I'm Canadian, so I don't like things that are unregulated. I found that quite flustering. But I'm also Canadian, so I can't confront anyone. So I just smiled harder and got into the car. And I wasn't even sure, do I get in the back seat or the front? But I thought, no, this has to be a taxi, surely. So I got in the back, and I started looking around. We started driving off towards Chicago, maybe. I've never been there before. And I was looking for signs of any officialness, and I didn't see any. So I said, you know, do you drive, you know, do you do this for a living? Is this a cab? And he said, no, I do it just for fun sometimes. Only when I'm lonely. I said, oh, wow. And so, you know, and smiled even harder. And then so we were driving along, and then he asked me what I was doing in Chicago, and I told him about The Bear. And he said, oh, do you know what a coincidence? Because I used to be called The Bear when I was little. And I said, why? And he said, oh, because I got in so many fights and all the kids were scared of me. And so I smiled even harder. And then he asked if there was quite a bit of traffic. So he asked if we wanted to go on back roads. And I said, no, we'll go on the main roads. So the good news is I'm here and I'm fine. And the other question is, what is Uber X? Yeah, whoops. Anyway, so traveling is always fun. But the reason I bring that up is because I think I've got the idea for my next novel, and I'll dedicate it to Jim Bull. Plot problem solved. That was very funny. Okay, so I'm going to read from just the beginning of The Bear, near the beginning. I'll just set it up briefly for you. So this book is based on, very loosely based on, a bear attack that happened in 1991 in Algonquin Park, which is a wilderness area about 3 hours north of Toronto in Canada. And in this particular attack, it was a very rare instance of a predatory black bear attack. And two adults were killed. And I was working in the park at the time, and I'll talk a bit more about that later, but it made an impression on me. So I started writing The Bear from my memories of that attack and the stories I heard about it rather than the facts, which is a crucial difference. So in my version, I added kids. So the narrator is Anna. She's 5 years old, and she is with her little brother, Sticky. He has sticky hands, so that's why she calls him that. And they have just been shoved into their large Coleman camping cooler, which is an old-fashioned one. And their father has slammed the lid down but put a rock in the side of Coleman's mouth. I'm gesturing because Anna thinks of Coleman as a person. And then clipped the latch, so it's bear-proof. But at the outset of the novel, the bear's on the scene. So I'm just going to read a short passage from that part. The other person you need to know besides Coleman, it's crucial, is Gwen, who's Anna's teddy bear. So she has him, Gwen, tucked under her arm most times. And then also the neighbor's dog in Toronto. So they're up north, but in Toronto, Anna lives beside Mrs. Buchanan, and Mrs. Buchanan has a dog named Snoopy. So that is the setup. Stick cries so much. I call Daddy and Mama, and my throat feels like the deck at the cottage that gives me splinters in my foot. No one is coming. I don't like splinters, and I don't want one in my throat. This is bad. It must be how we do time out in Toronto, or when I'm at the cottage. I don't sit on a step or on the porch. Here, I sit in Coleman. But I haven't talked, and I stayed still, and I was quiet for as long as the time out. And still Daddy won't let me out. I try to stick my eyes out of Coleman's mouth, but my forehead is too tall. I see stars, and the wind is not breathing. The noises are, I call Mummy and Daddy, and no one. I listen to other breath. It's not wind, it's not Stick's nose. The noises are Snoopy breathing. Mrs. Buchanan has given Snoopy a bone. I'm not allowed to, but Mrs. Buchanan lets me hold out the bone, and Snoopy takes it. He does it gentle, with his lips back, so I can see that his teeth aren't going to bite me, and he keeps them away from my hand. And when he is done with the bone and his dinner, he gives me a wet kiss on my cheek, and I smile. Snoopy is eating the bone, and I can hear the snap, snap, snap of the jaws on his jaws on the bone. His nose is snuffling because he is a pig when he eats. And he doesn't stop to breathe. I'm supposed to stop to breathe, even when I'm so hungry. Snoopy doesn't stop because he is a dog. His teeth go scrape on the bone, and I hear it pop. I think Snoopy has broken the bone, and he's not supposed to do that. It can get stuck in the roof of his mouth, and he has to go to the dog hospital. It happened once. I wasn't there. Mrs. Buchanan told me. Snoopy cried at the vet and got a needle to make him sleeping so that they could get the bone out. And the sounds outside, crack, crack, snap. And I know that Snoopy has broken the bone, but Mrs. Buchanan is not stopping him. Maybe she is sleeping because it is nighttime for her. Snoop, I call outside of Coleman's mouth. He doesn't listen. He keeps eating. Hey, Snoop, I say it louder. Behind me, I feel Stick twisting. He puts a knee in my back, but he is quiet and maybe having a snooze. I don't want to wake him up because he stopped whining after so long. Snoopy! I whisper. The chewing stops, and I hear Snoopy sniffing. The sniffing gets louder, and Snoopy is coming to see me. I stick my fingers out to say hello because I have one hand that isn't holding Gwen. There is a bad smell, and I put my fingers to my nose because my nostrils don't like the smell. Snoopy needs a bath. It smells like rotting leaves under the cottage and when there are fish guts in the boat. Yuck. Snoopy comes, and I see this big nose sniffing in the crack, but his smell is wrong, and it gives me the shakes, and I don't know why except the smell of fish. I don't like fish to eat. And the crack of Coleman goes dark, and there's hair there, and it is not Snoopy's, and it is prickly hair. It fills up the crack, and it turns out the lights, and I can't see. And Stick starts to cry because it's dark, and we get jerked. Stick pushes into me, and I grab Gwen, and Coleman shakes, and it is still dark, and I call Daddy. We shake harder, and I hear huffs, and it stinks. I cover my mouth because I don't want to breathe in and the smell, and Stick is crying, and then I am too. And we shake more, and we flip. I roll back, and my head goes clunk on Coleman. There's growling and a sound like Mama is making lunch and using the top of Coleman to cut apples with a knife. But it is not Mama, because her hair is yellow, and she always gives me a piece of apple first. It is louder and more like there are 10 mamas cutting apples, but that is too many and they wouldn't fit. And it is dark and flashing on and off, and I can see Stick on his side crying, and I need Daddy because it isn't Snoopy, and I'm not supposed to talk to strange dogs because we don't know them. I'm on my back, and Stick gets shoved into me, and I don't mind, and I grab his arm and pull him in, and Gwen too, and we cry and scrape, scrape, scrape. I see fur and hear too much breath and squeeze Stick and Gwen, and my eyes shut tight, and we cry. My tears are gone when the scraping stops. Coleman stays on his back with the rock in his mouth. The black dog is not scratching Coleman. He goes back to his sniffing and huffing, and then he starts cracking the bone. Stick and I are huddled in tight. Stick's head is heavy like a bowling ball, and it makes my arm go fuzzed, and he snuggles in. It is so dark outside Coleman, and no Daddy and Mummy, and after a while, I watch the lids of my eyes close down like jaws. So that is that's chapter 4 of The Bear. And this is when my publicist says that I'm supposed to say, it's ultimately uplifting. So it's kind of a dark passage. But there is humor in it, and I'll explain why in a moment. Really, The Bear came about when two different sides of my life sort of came together and almost clashed, I guess. And I thought I'd describe those two different sides. So the first, as I mentioned, was this bear attack that happened in 1991. So I was working as a camp counselor in Algonquin Park and leading trips, 11 to 14-year-old girls, for usually a week long at a time. So the attack actually happened in October, and it was in the Canadian newspapers, but pretty much after the fact, directly after it happened. So there wasn't too much detail for the avid bear watcher that I was. It was really just the basics were reported. And so when I went back to camp the next summer, myself and everyone else who worked there, of course, wanted to know the details. Especially in retrospect, we wanted to know what that couple had done wrong, how they had brought this bear attack upon themselves. And we exchanged information, sort of searching for that answer. And I remember it almost being like telling ghost stories. We'd gather around the campfire and eat marshmallows and trade what we knew about the attack. So it was sort of hanging over me, but I was also young enough, a little bit like Anna, that I could also just keep going and enjoy Algonquin Park and not worry about it too much. But after I left the park, I went on to tree plant in Northern Ontario, which is what it sounds like. It's sort of reforesting Canada, and it's a way that a lot of university students used to put themselves through school. But there I encountered a lot of black bears. A few lived in our camp because, of course, they were the problem bears that had been taken out of Algonquin Park and put in the middle of nowhere, which is where we happen to be. But those were very normal. They were garbage bears habituated to humans, and it was a very normal experience. So they, you know, you'd hear them in the middle of the night. You'd smell them often, and that's where Anna's keen sense of smells of bears comes from. And I slept with a pot and a pan at the bottom of my bed, and I'd clang them together and the bears would run off, or someone would blow a horn and they'd go away. I remember one morning I woke up and my friend said, "Why are you eating apples?" And I said, "I'm not eating apples." And she said, "Well, someone is." And I stuck my head out the tent. There was a bear. Someone had left a box of apples. And there's quite a small black bear eating, you know, taking a bite and throwing it away, and then another bite of a new one. And it almost, I laughed. It looked more like a raccoon or something with how dexterous the bear was. After that, I went out west and I started climbing, and I worked for Outward Bound in Oregon. There's one instance where I was hiking alone near Canmore in Alberta, and I saw a grizzly bear. And I was 2 days, 2.5 days into a 5-day loop and came around a switchback. And I was so glad to, you know, finally have gained the open meadow for the views there. And there was a grizzly about 200 yards ahead on the path. And the grizzly raised its head and, you know, I thought I could sort of see it sniffing, and then it sort of shrugged and went about its business. And I, on the other hand, sort of sniveled and squealed, and I dropped my pack because it had food in it. And I went back around the corner so I could no longer see the grizzly, and climbed a tree, which isn't actually that helpful behavior around a grizzly. But I think the point here is that I climbed, when I finally composed myself and stopped sniveling, I climbed back down and the grizzly was gone and it couldn't have cared less about me. And these are very normal bear experiences, that bears either are very intimidated by us and run away, or they're indifferent and they don't care. So the more I started to experience and read about bears, the more I started to wonder, well, what then happened in Algonquin Park? And it was sort of a constant digging at the back of my mind. So when I started, I sat down to write The Bear. I had actually finished another novel that's now what I call one of my dead books. But at the point at which I started writing this, I thought it was still alive. And I was just taking a break and used to writing. And I remember the Monday I sat down and I had a blank Word document, and I thought, well, normally I'd be quite intimidated if I had a blank Word document, but I'll just write a short story, it will be fine. And and I thought of this bear attack, and that's when I sort of started writing. And about a third of the way into the novel, I started to realize that I had these hazy memories, but they were based on a lot of rumor and conjecture. So I started researching the actual bear attack and what had happened in retrospect, and found quite a few good journal articles and some primary sources to talk to. And what I found was the most startling revelation that I could for me at the time, which was that this couple had done nothing wrong to bring this bear attack on them. They were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. It was a lone male, a young male black bear. And they think at the southernmost, bears tend to travel in big circles, and at the southern end of its range, and it had probably been kicked out of its mother's care the year before, so it was slightly desperate and winter was coming, so it decided to take a chance on a new source of food. And there's a bear biologist at the University of Calgary who has a working theory that seems to be playing out, that if a bear has successfully taken down a moose calf, that a human isn't such a big leap. Again, though, it takes just the right kind of bear. So bears have different personalities just as humans do. So it's a very, very rare incident that happened. But what I realized is that I'd been searching for what that couple had done wrong, because that is a wonderful way to feel safer. That if you can isolate what they did wrong, then all you have to do is not repeat that, and then you're safe. And unfortunately, that's not the way the world works, and terrible things happen all the time and that people don't bring upon themselves. So I was having this sort of realization right at the point where my children were young, and I was thinking about taking them out into the wilderness and what that meant. And it was never a question if I would or not. My husband and I are avid outdoors people, but it was a matter of how I would do that and where and how I'd feel about it while we were out. So around this same time, perhaps just a little bit before, I reread Lord of the Flies. And Lord of the Flies was very seminal for me in that, you know, I was an Outward Bound instructor, so we'd be, in that case, they were quite extreme trips. There were 30 days and, you know, there was a solo where the students fasted and all sorts of things. So anytime there was some sort of stress, and there was quite often, you know, we'd sit back and say, oh, here's the Lord of the Flies moment. And it often did get quite ugly, and you saw sort of, you saw maybe people's true selves or their stress selves anyway. But when I reread Lord of the Flies, I had two boys of my own by that point. And I realized what a mean take on human nature that book has, and especially on little boys. And I felt quite angry in a way that I had let that book define so much of my outdoor experience and my view of little boys before I had them. So I started writing The Bear, and it was actually about two little boys in the first draft. And my point was very much that they care for each other in some ways, and that they have a relationship together. So my son, it probably will not surprise you to hear, if you've read the book, that he was five when I started writing as well. And he was going through a stage where he was kind of a late talker. So his at five, nearly six, his vocabulary was all of a sudden catching up to his inner life. And I was quite surprised at this person that I was suddenly meeting. So I think as a mother, I'd got quite used to talking for him when he couldn't talk. And I'm sure I was very guilty of talking over him as well, as opposed to listening. So there's one day, it was quite a dark November, just when the light starts to get low and parenting gets a little bit harder for some reason. And someone had peed somewhere, and there was a broken toy, and I was late with dinner. There was all these, it felt like everything was going on. And my son was demanding my attention and wanted to know why that my system for distributing Band-Aids was so irregular and haphazard. And I remember just like, I could feel the smoke coming out my ears, and I was just about to do a big mama bear yell. And I took a breath and I thought, well, what if I just tried to listen? And, you know, because he had a proposal. So I listened, and his proposal was that cuts that have blood should get Band-Aids and no other cut, you know, no, nothing else, no scratch, none of this like fake owie, just cuts that have Band-Aid or that have blood. And I thought, well, actually that's quite a good idea. So that is our policy going forward. We stick to that. But the point was that I started listening more, and I started asking him questions. And we started having conversations like we never had before. And it was like getting to know him. And it was entertaining and humorous in many ways. His grandmother had also died the year previously, I think. So we started talking about what that meant. And he could articulate a little bit more about how his sort of ideas around death and what had happened to her. And I didn't read too much about psychology, child psychology, because I wanted to make sure that this was about one child, not a generalization about many. But I did actually read a very helpful thing by a woman who categorized a child's conception of death as they grow. And her idea was that around 5-6 is when their idea of death becomes more solid and they start to realize that it's a permanent state. So that, and I could see in him, some days he seemed to know what had happened to his grandmother's, and other days he didn't. And it was sort of patchy. And then when he turned about, he was a little bit of a late bloomer. So around 6.5, he sort of solidified his thinking around that. So that became a real hinge point for the book. So the book is actually narrated by Anna, who's a girl. So I guess the boy was actually six. And then everyone read it, said, oh, no, that's a five-year-old. And I'd based it on my six-year-old. But anyway. In the first draft, I had in the current draft, there's a small epilogue where they're sort of grown up. And you meet Anna as a 20-year-old. But in the first draft, I had a much longer section. And I was having trouble writing a grown-up boy. And it was actually my agent, Denise Bukowski, who said, you know, when I read that section, it sounds a lot like a woman talking. And my reaction to that was to say nothing and then go into a snit for a few days. I didn't want to hear that at all. Oh, because of Lord of the Flies, because I was writing a rebuttal to Lord of the Flies. So it had to be two boys. So I took 3 days and I calmed down a little bit, and I reread the section and I thought she was right. And then I went back and read the younger child and it was all, I realized how much of the character was actually me. You know, I'd been thinking that I was basing it on my son and in some ways it is the emotional scope, but there was a lot of me in there. My experience of being a girl and of caring for my younger cousins. So that was, and then all of a sudden I realized that I could write a book about a strong little girl, and that was incredibly appealing. So I had to call my agent back and say, yes, I think you're right. so that's sort of how I think this book ended up having a little bit of humor, a lot of love, and a bit of fear. I think those things all sort of mixed together because I was very much grappling with the idea of having children that are growing up and going into a world that isn't always under your control. So that's kind of the story of the bear and how it came together. I'd love to take questions if anyone has any. Or, yes,
how old is the bear when it leaves its mother? Is it 2 years?
It's around two, yeah. So they're young. Exactly. I think they're, and some of them are not aggressive at all. I mean, most of them. There's actually a little review in People magazine about the book, and it said this book could do for camping what Jaws did to beaches. And I thought, oh, what have I done? Which, because I think. I mean, and I hope I have an author's note in the beginning that this is a very, there's a few individuals who do things that most won't, and the same with bears. But on the other hand, bears do remind us that we're not at the top of the pecking order all the time, too. There's some humility in thinking about bears.
Does the voice kind of come back to you now? And what, if so, what do you do with it? Voices work in general. Are you waiting for another voice for your next book to sort of come into your head?
That's a good question. So that is how do I come across a voice, and is that voice still with me? And that voice is still with me because I started writing another book. I did a few pages and I realized I was writing an 8-year-old, and I was just Anna was just a little bit more grown up, but I don't actually want to do that. So my first book was called The Line Painter, and it was very voice driven as well. It was sort of it's a little bit of a thriller, I suppose, but it to me it's all about the voice, and the voice drives what happens with the characters. I tend to start out writing with just sort of an idea and a voice. But what I'm working on now is much more, it's a different kind of character, and I find I'm writing my way in. I hope I am. So I'm just sort of starting to feel it gel, but it's quite frustrating because I'm doing draft after draft. But I'm a impulsive writer.
Can you force yourself to come up with a voice?
That's what I don't think you can do. So I've had a few people ask, how did you sustain the voice in this book, and did you have a sheet with certain words that she'd use and that sort of thing? And I actually didn't do that. Writing this book was much more like acting, I think. The voice was whispering. I was trying to finish another book, and the voice was, I'm a runner, so I'd go running, and I have it was talking, and I don't mean to make it sound like I'm channeling or anything like that. It just becomes strong enough that it can answer questions and things. So it was that voice that when I had the blank word document that sort of pushed itself in. Yeah. I wish that would happen more. I've been kind of like, so who else wants to come along? But I'm not sure that's realistic. And I'd like to be a little bit more directed than that. I hope I'm maturing to that point. I don't know. We'll see. Yes.
What do you like to read what did you read that inspired this writing?
Okay. So what did I read that inspired this writing? I'm repeating the questions for the podcast. Lord of the Flies was a big one for this, in the sort of like angry get me writing camp. I read a lot of adventure stories. I went through a big whaling, like I reread Moby Dick, and then I went in this huge mutiny on the Bounty kick and that sort of thing. So I'm and Krakauer, and I'm into that sort of adventure side, but I'm very interested in literary fiction too. So I think what I am, I've just decided this last week, so don't hold me to it, but what I always have a new theory, and this is it, that I really want to do those sort of traditional adventure tales, but use literary techniques to kind of mess with them a bit. One of my favorite all-time books, this has been 2 years running, I think, is The Road by Cormac McCarthy. I just love the language in that. It's exquisite. And that's the one I find myself just reading and rereading paragraphs, which is so artfully done. Yeah. I actually often get jealous when I read to that particular book, but I read to page 15, and it's amazing how he's used such sparse language, and you know exactly the world and that the characters are in and how it what happened, and you can see it. It's incredible, the few details. So that inspires me. Yeah. Did I reread Lord of the Flies, or did I remember? I reread it, and that's why it got me mad. I think if I just remembered it, I would have remembered it as I always did. It's kind of true, and it definitely has a thing, but it's a great book. It's really great, and I have a real love-hate with it. And it always comes up, actually, too.
I guess because you have boys.
Yes, in the camping, and it's been just there. But I guess it's a little bit like my relationship with bears, and that, you know, I have a love-hate with them, too. Things that tug you both ways can be the most compelling, I think.
It's just odd, because you have to read that as an adolescent. Like, my daughter just read it. But it's very different when you read it as an adult.
It is a book. Yes.
It's a really different experience versus kind of thinking, I know Piggy, I know that kid, that kid. Instead, you're like, oh, these poor children.
Yes.
Stranded on the island, and how will we get
them? Yes.
It's just a really different, so I just wondered if you read that.
It's a great point about books that change with you as you age. And that's, to me, the mark of a really great book, I think. Because that's quite right. I remember identifying Piggy and, yeah. Yes, and trying to sort of compose your high school based on that. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yes. Whereas when you read it later in life, you want to go in and take charge and sort all these people out. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think part of it was sort of following your worst fears? You know, when we have small children, that is our worst fears. Two. One, that something's going to happen to us so that we can't take care of them. The other, that something's going to happen to them. But in this one, I think, were you not exploring the fear of what if something happens to you, right? And then the mother scene at the end there, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a little bit of a hopefulness in that maybe that character saw the kids were going to be okay.
Yeah. I wrote, for anyone who's read the book, I wrote the epilogue for myself and any parent just as a little my mom actually read it and she said, oh, thank you. Just sort of so this is a question about I guess the background drive to why I wrote the book. And when I wrote it, I think I was on the second draft. I had lunch with a friend who knows me well. And she said, I told her about the book and I said, you know, I'm writing about how I can't always protect my children. And, you know, it's a scary thought to have that something might happen to them and you can't help and that sort of thing. And my friend stopped and she said, no, that's not what you're writing about. You're writing about what if you're not there for your children at all. And it's a perceptive point, and from then I realized she was right. My father died when I was young, and I think that is something that preoccupies me a lot of the time. I see my kids with like holes in their sweatpants, you know, going off to school, because my husband takes the kids to school in the morning, and I think, what if I'm not here? They're going to always have holes in their pants. Or, you know, it is sort of a recurring theme, but not one that I had identified. So I think actually writing this book, although I didn't do it consciously, and I think often that's it, that the greatest meaning comes out in your writing when you're doing it unconsciously. It helped me sort of see that I had that fear. And I don't know, when you bring something to light like that, it can be useful for realizing why it's there and trying to identify if it's rational or not. Which is another point with bears too. How rational is it to spend all your life worried about bears? Yeah. No, it's a, yeah. Yeah. And I actually took my kids back to Algonquin Park last summer. So it was my poor husband was rolling his eyes the whole time saying, we're going on a trip where? But I wanted to go back to the park to kind of make my peace with it. And what I found was it was the same old island and the same beautiful lake, and it was stunning. And I'd been there so much that I knew I had young kids and I knew there was bears, but it was very useful for reminding myself that you need to just keep going and you can't let this kind of irrational fear stop you from doing things. But I did, I thought I'd have some moment where I'd, like, I don't know, would I bury a manuscript page or something like that, but there was a storm and everything had got wet and we'd spent the day drying everything out, and by the time we got to the island, I was so tired. I was like, "Ah, there it is. We're going home." Yeah. So it was sort of anticlimactic in a good way, I think.
Were you nervous going?
So was I nervous going back to Algonquin Park? I obviously have an overactive imagination to some extent. But the minute I got in the tent, I realized how many nights I'd spent in a tent and that it was fine. So I didn't, yeah, I thought about it. I was more nervous about, one of them was a non-swimmer and it was it's quite extreme. It's quite far north. And there's lightning storms and things. So there's plenty of things to be nervous about. But it was actually, I knew too, and I know enough about bears to take solace in the fact that it was a really good blueberry year. So I knew we were fine. Yeah, it's just good. A fed bear is a happy bear. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm happy to sign books and answer questions. Thank you very much for coming this evening. I really appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.